Welcome to My Favorite Mystic, a podcast about the weird and wonderful world of mysticism. I'm AJ Langley, and today I'm joined by Rowan Wilson. Rowan is a DPhil candidate at the University of Oxford. Their thesis focuses on failures of feeling in late medieval devotional literature. Alongside this, they're also interested in tracing queer and trans threads in medieval texts. Rowan, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited.
I'm excited to have you. This is going to be great. So today you're here to speak to us about Walter Hilton.
Yes.
But before we talk about him, let's talk about you. How did you find yourself studying medieval mysticism and devotional texts?
That's a good question. In undergrad, I happened upon this tradition of what's called like the pseudo-Bernardine Marian dialogues, whereby St. Bernard of Clairvaux is imagined in dialogue with the Virgin Mary, and he's approaching her because he's said to her, "Mary, I'm not feeling appropriately for the Passion. I'm not being stimulated to tears. Can you please tell me what happened to your son and the excruciating narrative of his death in order that I can feel as I know I should?" And she pushes back and there's this kind of friction. She says, "I don't want to tell you that story." And he says, "Please." And she says, "No." And he says, "Please." And she says, "Okay." And she does. And these texts and that friction between the devotee and Mary and this idea of what it is to try to stimulate yourself towards a feeling you're struggling to access made me think about how the experiences of medieval devotees, like surrounded by a culture that expects them to feel and respond in certain ways, must have been exhausting, must have been excruciating to have to just like grift your way into certain responses. And then I started kind of looking at various programs for meditation, stuff that takes you through the canonical hours of every day, and the notion of just like waking up in the morning, sitting and contemplating unspeakable horrors being inflicted on a human body until the conclusion of the canonical hours, if you're following these programs to the letter. I was just so struck by the weariness of that and the strain of that. And it made me very interested in thinking about, I guess, strain more broadly. And yeah, I just got sucked into the vortex. Also, I read a lot of Marjorie Kemp when I was about 19. And that's the lure for many people, I think.
Honestly, though, reading the book of Marjorie Kemp seems to have had such a profound impact on so many scholars at such a young age. I think we really need to consider assigning it with some form of caution, because we are profoundly affecting lives when we have people read that. I do completely love that the Virgin Mary is pushing back against this request. She's obviously the person you would go to if you want to work on being sad enough about the death of Christ, but her lamentations and misery and sadness in that moment is so profound and deep. And to be like, "Hey, I understand you are sad about this, but I'm not sad enough. So could you relive the worst moment of your entire life in order to make me understand just how truly sad it was?" It is just ridiculous as a request. And so I like that she refuses it, but it also does show how desperately he wants to understand what it is to feel the appropriate amount of sadness, and that there is an expectation there that you would feel this very, very deeply.
Yeah, right, exactly. And it made me think a lot about the ways in which we approach narratives of trauma. And, you know, there's been lots of kind of theorization of the crucifixion as this traumatic kernel, I think that's Paul Sturm's phrase, at the heart of medieval devotional culture. But the ways in which we often kind of come to people who have suffered something excruciating and treat them as like a resource, and we can extract this juice that will make us engage in a way that satisfies us or sometimes gives us pleasure or makes us feel better about ourselves. And yeah, I think there's very clear consonances with trauma theory and with very immediate modern questions. And I think that's something that struck me a lot looking at devotional literature more broadly.
And I love the way that this was phrased in your bio and phrased in your work, this failures of feeling, because it implies that they know that they're supposed to feel a way and that they're trying to feel a particular way and that they just can't get there. And the assumption seems to be in Vitae and in devotional literature that those feelings are automatic, that they show your connection to the church, to the stories that you're reading, to God. And so if you aren't feeling those feelings to the intensity that would be assumed, it does kind of seem like it might underline your entire religiosity and imply that you're lacking in devotion, even if you're really making an effort, but just can't quite get there to feel the feelings.
Yeah, exactly. And I think lots of the scholarship on affective piety and trying to engage emotionally and passionately with devotional material kind of works, basically takes those manuals at their word and suggests that those kinds of scripts for feeling function as stipulated, right? And I think trying to push back against that and dig underneath those normative structures is what I'm interested in. And I think there's all sorts of reasons why people might not feel as they're expected to feel, you know, thinking both about people who are simply like exhausted by the demands of these programs, but also thinking about neurodivergent experiences of feeling, thinking about people who, for whatever reason, might have non-normative experiences of empathy. I think for me, thinking kind of about and with autism as like a way of reading is important. This is something that we see today, and it seems implausible to me that it wouldn't also have existed in medieval contexts.
Absolutely. And we have so many examples of people processing grief and sadness and anger in different ways that to assume that there's only one way to feel about anything doesn't really make any sense. And to use that feeling as proof of piety seems wildly unfair to these people who are dedicating their lives to the faith and desperately trying to have that connection. And I have to imagine that even with the refocusing on the humanity of Christ in the 12th and 13th centuries, it is just such a long time removed to still be desperately sad about something that happened 1200 years ago that you never witnessed and have only heard about through stories. Even if you are desperately seeking that profound connection with God, to get to the point where you can be so incredibly sad about something that you are so temporally removed from must be really difficult.
Exactly. And I'm thinking about how rare, so Marjorie Kemp, one of my favorite bits in Marjorie is when she's, you know, having one of her bouts of crying, as she does, and the priest is like, Marjorie, Jesus died a while ago, chill out. And she says, sir, his death is as fresh to me as he had died this same day. And so it should be to all Christian people. And that kind of notion of being able to experience the passion in a sort of eternal and reiterative present, it seems implausible to me that that would have been a ubiquitous experience. And what is distinctive about Marjorie is the violence with which the passion like erupts into her daily existence. The majority, or many people, it seems to me, might find themselves in a situation where they can't feel like Christ died this same day, where his death doesn't feel fresh. It feels like repetitive matter to which you could even just become inured, right? Like, we see this all the time. We live in a world in which we are, as modern viewers, bombarded with images of suffering. And at a certain point, in order to continue your existence in a way that is tolerable, you cease to feel it with that first like sudden spur, right? You cease to feel the pain of it with the violence that you did when you first encountered it. And given how repetitive and how the repetition of the image of the crucifixion is kind of built into medieval devotional culture, you'd get tired, right? Like, this is the thing. It's kind of wearisome. It's a wearisome thing to confront.
Absolutely. I could just listen to you talk about your research all day, but we are here to speak about one particular person. So I'm going to forcibly shift us over to talking about Walter Hilton. Do you remember your first impressions when you came across this man?
Yeah, so I think in line with my research more broadly, I was trying to get at the most popular texts of particularly like later medieval England is my area of focus. And as we know, devotional matter is being circulated and compiled at a faster rate than texts of any other genre. And so I was just kind of like, I was going through the big hitters. I was thinking about Nicholas Love's Meditation on the Life of Christ. I was looking at The Pricking of Love, which is sometimes attributed to Hilton. I was looking at Rolla. And then I came to The Scale of Perfection, which I think has something like 62 manuscripts. And that's Hilton's most famous and widely diffused work. And I think initially I was not enraptured, right? Because he's not a very rapturous guy. He's not a guy who is oriented towards the kinds of mystical ecstasies that often the thing that causes people to fall in love with this period and these writers, people like Julian, people like Marjorie, to a lesser degree, I think people like Rolla, people like Cloud Author, there was a kind of sternness and like a flatness to Hilton's tone and Hilton's address and Hilton's very pastoral address that I found initially kind of off-putting. And then I got lured in, and now, you know, I die for him. I die for this extremely dead, 14th century canon.
It's so poetic. I love that you had your own failure of feeling towards Hilton that you ultimately corrected. That's great.
Yes, yes, yes.
Great. So let's talk about him then. What do we know about Walter Hilton, his biography? What was his life like? Just give us a rundown. What do we know?
We actually know kind of a fair bit. So he was born around 1340. The thing about Walter Hilton is that he seems to have skipped around a lot of careers, which is profoundly relatable. He was not kind of a perennial dropout, but he seems to have attempted and quit multiple things in a way I personally find very compelling. So we have a record of like a Walter de Hilton who was at the University of Cambridge, we think studying law, and then we have an allusion to this kind of Walter de Hilton figure who is kind of in the process of acquiring a kind of bachelor's in canon law. Then the next kind of biographical indication we have is that sometime in the 1380s, so when he's about 40, he tries to become solitary and he seems to spend some time in kind of hermit mode. And we know this because he writes a letter called De Imagine Peccati in which he characterizes himself like this to a friend. But then pretty soon after that, in the mid 1380s, in another one of his early Latin letters, we essentially have him saying that being a solitary is proving rough stuff and he doesn't know if he can hack it much longer. And he is unsure of his vocation and he's thinking about joining a religious community, so living a very different kind of life. And then we next know him as a kind of member of the Augustinian community of Thurcaton Priory, this group of canons regular. And he seems to spend the rest of his life there until he dies in 1396. It's great to have a death day, 24th March, if anyone wants to celebrate the feast of Walter Hilton's death day.
Well, there you have it, everyone. Next year, March 24th, Walter Hilton Day. We're going to make a big deal. It's going to be great. So you mentioned that we have one text kind of describing himself. Let's talk a little bit about the corpus of work that we have. What kinds of things do we have to help us know who this man is? Do we have his own writings? Do people write about him? What's the textual basis look like?
Yes, so he's quite prolific. He writes a lot in both English and Latin. And mainly we have him speaking to distinct addressees and often kind of positioning himself in a pastoral role. So trying to support people on their own devotional journeys or enter into dialogue with people in their own devotional journeys. The earliest works, as I say, are these Latin letters. The first is, I think, to an unnamed male addressee, De Imagine Peccati, and then there's this text, De Utilitate Progativis Religionis, which is addressed to a kind of locatable individual, this guy Adam Horsley. Then in the middle of his career, he seems to start writing more in Middle English. There's a short treatise of Angel Song, which is a kind of a weird diss track on, or like an investigation of or interrogation of, a very popular aspect of Richard Rolla's spirituality. Then there's another Middle English treatise called The Epistle on the Mixed Life, which is essentially about how to balance your contemplative responsibilities or your desire to access contemplative intimacy with God with your life in the world. A couple of other Middle English texts, and then also crucially, The Scale, which is written in two books, addressed to an anchoress, so a woman religious. And so he writes the first book, and then there's a longer second book, which seems to be responding to questions she had, which I really like because it gives this sense of ongoing dialogue. And I always like when you can reach back and imagine this conversation, parts of which have dropped out, but that they're kind of digging into it together. And because Hilton is in many ways such a social writer, we can think about this whole constellation of voices who are participating in the construction of this theology. And then his last work is this Latin letter called Firmissime Crede, which is about doubts and scruples. And he's a man very deeply preoccupied with doubts and scruples and with how to sit with your own thoughts and feelings in a context in which you're constantly being bedeviled by these little niggling uncertainties, these things that kind of prevent you from immersing yourself fully and contentedly in the embrace of divine love. In many ways, he's a very practical mystic, which feels like a contradiction in terms, right? And I think that's one of the reasons why he's less evocative and less tempting and less seductive than, I don't know, the visionary ecstasies of Julian or the radical apophatic program of the Cloud author. He is writing for people who are waking up in the morning and realizing that they have to sit with contemplation for the next several hours, right? He's writing about the stuff of a contemplative life as much as, if not more than, he is writing about mystical experience.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I myself am partial to an ecstatic vision full of indecipherable imagery, but I do think it's really important that we acknowledge the role of these practical texts because, as you mentioned earlier, people don't necessarily know how to do this, how to engage with the religious life in an effective way.
Yeah, exactly. And these kinds of highly individualized experiences of transport, vision, ecstasy are precisely that. They're so individually dependent, and in some ways they're thus not necessarily a terribly reliable window into more ubiquitous aspects of devotional experience, of people who are just trying as hard as they can to approach something wonderful, i.e. this contact with the divine. And Hilson's kind of mystical system, insofar as he has one, is not terribly original. Like, the parts of him that we could characterize as mystical are kind of a cope of the work of Richard of St. Victor. Who's this kind of earlier Scottish mystic. So the parts in which he's describing anything close to mystical transport or mystical transcendence, when he's talking about the darkness through which the mind must pass and the soul must pass in order to access God, I think we find more evocative and original articulations of that in something like The Cloud Author, the kind of apophatic program of The Cloud of Unknowing, and that kind of vivid notion of the cloud of forgetting through which you have to pass in order to access the cloud of unknowing. His descriptions of mystical feelings when he talks about how sometimes God will fill you with a kindling in your heart and a sweetness on your tongue if you're lucky. These things are given more vivid and personal articulation in the works of someone like Rolla when we're trying to locate Hilton in this context of later medieval Middle English mysticism. So if you're reading Hilton as a mystic, I think this is maybe a terrible thing to say on this podcast in particular, I think you're liable to be disappointed. But if you're reading him as a person who is sitting with experiences of contemplation, and contemplation is something that happens in a potentially a drab and drafty anchor hold when you are trying to approach God but you're finding yourself distracted because you're hungry or you're thinking about someone you haven't seen in years or your cat's just run into the room, right? That's what I read Hilton for, this notion of contemplation as work, as labor, with all of the potentially tedious and distracting and painful aspects of labor, because he is someone for whom religious life was a full-time job. And this is true for many of his addressees as well, often in conditions of privation and extremity that we can't really imagine. I'm thinking particularly about anchoritic life.
And, you know, a full-time job that he job hopped, as you mentioned. He also had a hard time engaging full time with these different kinds of devotions and expectations of the religious life.
Yeah, he was nearly a lawyer, which is very funny to me. Maybe he did practice, we don't know. Right, but so he's trying to find a home for himself in the divine, and it seems like that is something with which he struggles, and therefore he's able to kind of address the struggles of people trying to locate themselves in religious life with, I think, more compassion and grace than some other mystical writers.
And it really does seem like we're engaging with this separation between cultivated and spontaneous experience, that spontaneous experience is seen as preferable and superior, when cultivated experience was probably actually a lot more common. It's much more likely that people were engaging with the divine through meditation and contemplation and behaviors and rituals in order to try and create these connections, and less likely that someone almost gets struck by lightning with a revelation. So even though there is a clear preference for the spontaneous, we shouldn't be neglecting these guides which teach us about cultivation and about what that was like as a practical experience for those living a religious life every single day.
Yes, exactly. And I think this is the thing about the genre of devotional manual. You wouldn't have a manual if everyone knew how to do it, right? You would not write something that's a guide to how to accomplish a process if it were intuitive. And there is a voracious appetite for this kind of literature. And as I say, The Scale of Perfection is, in an English context, is sort of one of these medieval bestsellers, quote unquote, in that it has these kind of 60-something manuscripts, right? So it's clear that people are hungry for guides. People are hungry for things that will accompany them through the hard grind of striving to leave behind your earthly life and approach something transcendent. And I think, yeah, you're right that we are we are so easily seduced by that vision of easy access and kind of spontaneous access. And actually Hilton himself writes about this, right? Because it seems like he is in this one-sided feud with notably dead Richard Roller throughout a lot of his career.
Notably dead Richard Roller. I love that. Okay, please elaborate. Why is he trying to pick a fight with Richard Roller, even though he's dead?
Roller is someone who autobiographically seems to write about himself experiencing exactly these kinds of transport. He receives the fire of love and it doesn't leave him for the duration of his contemplative life. Roller is a successful hermit, a successful solitary, in a way that Hilton seems not to have been. And so when Hilton writes in something like The Scale or something like Of Angel Song about these sorts of rapturous experiences, these experiences that just sweep you out of your earthly life completely, hearing a song descend into your ear, he writes about them with a real caution for how seductive and appealing they might be. And he also writes for people who might read such descriptions and think, well, I've never had anything like that in my life. So like there's a bit in The Scale where he talks about meditation on the holy name, on the name of Christ, which is one of Roller's favorite little points to come back to. And he ventriloquizes this devotee who has read in holy books that those who fail to experience their hearts bursting with sweetness when they meditate on the holy name won't find that sweetness and that union in heaven. And he, ventriloquizing this devotee, says, "These words stoneth me, they astonish me, and they make me greatly afraid." So he is thinking very deeply and very compassionately about people for whom these images of, or these descriptions of, mystical rapture might just be that. They might be images or descriptions. They might be something aspirational, but not something that could ever be internalized. And he also writes with real suspicion about those kinds of experiences. He talks about sweetness, heat, ardor as something that is often experienced in the beginning stages of contemplative life, which kind of makes sense, right? We hear about kind of the fervor of converts. And it's this thing of when you embark on something new, you're easily enraptured. And Hilton says, but what are you going to do when you don't feel that anymore? What are you going to do when that passes from you and you have to wake up and pray, and you have to wake up and pray without feeling the assurance that someone is listening back? Or what are you going to do when you become so enraptured with your own feelings that you are working solely in order to sustain them? You're trying to master your feelings, and he uses this word mastery a lot. You're kind of straining every fiber of your being in order to enter transports. You're maybe losing sleep, you're not eating. The Epistle on the Mixed Life, which is another one of these Middle English works, has this very sensible, like your nicest university professor advice of like, go to bed, get a good 8 hours, wake up, try again. Do not spend your whole life straining to experience something spontaneous. And this kind of tension between what we associate with mysticism, transport, rapture, abstraction from the world, something sweeping into your life, and the reality of the fact that many of the people we think of as mystics were professional mystics, not all of them, but many of them were people for whom this was their entire life. I mean, you think about someone like Julian, who is someone who seems to have experienced vision once in her life over a 2 or 3 day period, I can't remember, when she was in a state of extreme bodily privation. And then the rest of her life is devoted to a process of understanding of, or engagement with, that one visionary experience. Roller, as this person who experiences the fire of love all through his life, is exceptional. And it's why he becomes iconic in later medieval England, because he is exceptional. It's why there's this attempted canonization of him very soon after his death. But the majority of people are not Roller, and the majority of people are not Julian. The majority of people are not Hilton, right? But he seems to be writing for a broader majority. And he, in fact, uses that language. He talks about the many of us who aren't able to access these feelings, or not able to access them reliably.
As far as his own engagement, do we have any information about his own mystical experiences, his own attempts to strive towards union with the divine? Or are these works purely focused on giving guidance and assurance and comfort to those who are attempting to make these connections but just aren't quite there yet?
Yeah, I mean, this is tricky, right? Because the notion of autobiography is always a vexed one. And we know that many medieval writers are kind of suspicious about positing themselves as authorities. And Hilton is very much kind of in this category. So his descriptions of his own uncertainty or scruples could just be operating as a humility topos. But they come with remarkable frequency. And some of the earliest depictions of his own experiences of strain are in that letter, De Utilitate et Prerogativis Religionis. And in that, he talks to this guy, Adam Horsley, who is on the verge of entering the religious life. And he says, "You're lucky. You have a sense of occasion." He says, "I, wretched person." He talks about himself as an individual who is straining to feel what his friend is feeling, which is this kind of certainty about religious life and the certainty about where he fits into a scheme. But in actuality, he's foundering, and we know that he seems to call it quits pretty soon after, specifically on the solitary life, and join a community. And then whenever in later works he describes mystical experience, he often offers a little nota bene, like a little cautionary note saying, "I'm writing about things I haven't personally experienced." And he says this at the end of Angel's Song. There's this moment where he completely diminishes his own pastoral status. He says to the addressee, "If you can find someone, another advisor, who has experienced these things, who knows a lot more about them than I do, who can help you to hear this Angel's Song, you should go to him, because I don't know what I'm saying," right? He knows what he's read, but he doesn't necessarily know what it is to feel these things. And in The Scale of Perfection, he draws this distinction, which is kind of, I think, very important to his work as a whole, between those who experience reforming, this idea of reforming of life, those who experience it in faith alone, and those who experience it in both faith and in feeling. So there are some people who, in kind of experiencing it in faith alone, like, they know that salvation is real because they believe it intellectually, because it is like a truth that they have accepted, but they don't necessarily feel it every day. And then there are what he calls the kind of very few souls who receive that blessing of being able to feel the truth of it every day. And there's a chapter title that I really like, where in The Scale, which is something like, "On the reason why so few in comparison to the multitude of others experience reforming in faith and in feeling." And he locates himself in that multitude of others. He says that he is kind of reformed in faith, but his experiences of feeling have been fleeting, if they have happened at all. So he seems to stand in solidarity with the struggles and scruples of his addressees, right? And of course, this could just be a position that he occupies in order to be a better companion. We have no way of knowing. But I think kind of either way, whether this kind of urgency with which he addresses struggling devotees comes from his own experience, or whether he is simply trying to accompany those living in the struggle, living in that strain, I think there's a huge amount of grace and something like friendship in that.
I really love this brand of humility that's not, "Oh, I know nothing, woe is me," but is just practical of, "Hey, look, I'm only giving you what I've read in books. If you want more than that, you're going to have to find somebody who's actually experienced all of these things. This is just a synthesis of a reading list."
Yeah, right. And that's actually a really useful distinction to draw between the kind of cautionary humility and then a kind of humility that we might associate more conspicuously with other devotional programs. And he does this a bit, this idea of kind of, you know, going to God and being like, "I'm a wretch, I'm nothing, my life is nothing, my world is nothing, everyone I know is nothing." This absolute denial of your kind of earthly situation that we see echoed in a lot of contemplative programs of this same period. I'm thinking again about The Cloud Author. Did Hilton read The Cloud Author? Probably not, but The Cloud is for a long time like attributed to Hilton. And Hilton has some connections, it seems like, with the Carthusians, with the religious order that may or may not have produced The Cloud. So there are elements of him prostrating himself in the manner that you sometimes get told to prostrate yourself before God in order to split yourself off from the corruption of your bodily vessel and the kind of corruption of being a person with friends or loved ones. But there is also this much more pragmatic humility of, like, my authority is highly circumscribed by my own experience, and you should seek whatever works best for you. He's very insistent on that, seeking whatever works best for you, taking things at your own pace, taking contemplation at your own pace, not striving to master it, going to bed on time.
Go to bed on time is the absolute best possible advice in all circumstances. Everyone, just go to bed.
So true. I don't know other medieval mystics who are so insistent on bedtime, you know? It's great.
Okay, so we have all of these writings. We have at least one piece of really solid advice, which is just go to bed. What other kinds of things does he talk about in these writings? What other advice does he give? Are there key themes that he keeps hitting on? Let's dig into the kinds of things he's writing about.
Yeah, so I think the scale of profession has been taken to be the core of his program and his thought, and it's the longest text he writes in Middle English. And the scale is remarkable because it is mostly an account of the various ways in which your mind can trap you, and the various ways in which when you kind of sit down to contemplate, you can get lured elsewhere. And I find hugely relatable and hugely intimate this idea of the brain as trap. And so essentially, he spends more time on describing all of the things that can pull you out of contemplation than he does describing contemplation itself. And he talks about this in terms of things like memories of your pre-religious life, or alternatively, doubts about whether what you're feeling is from God or from the devil. And one of the most remarkable things about the scale of perfection to me is the fact that many of the things he describes sound like modern therapeutic advice. Like specifically, he says things that I remember being told by a CBT therapist when I was 17. He talks about negative feelings. He talks about feelings that give you uncertainty. And he says essentially, hold them slightly remote from yourself. Don't let them overtake you. Don't let them besiege you. Hold them up. Look at them. Examine them. Don't try to master them. Don't try to push them down and then let them go. He uses this phrase, dread it not too mickle. Don't have too much terror of these feelings. He says, instead, abide with them patiently. And this kind of patient sitting with your own uncertainties, your own fears, your own crises, your own memories is sort of kind of at the core of a lot of what he is advising. And in this, we can kind of draw connections with a lot of the literature on temptation that is coming out roughly same time, kind of later medieval, and particularly in England, stuff like William Fleet. So there's that preoccupation of his, this kind of obsessive concern about the ways that your greatest enemy is your own mind. So true. But then another thing which I find fascinating about Hilton is he's often characterized as a very orthodox thinker. And I think in many ways this is true. He doesn't propose anything which is theologically suspect. He's quite careful about that. But there's this kind of interesting interrogation that runs throughout his work of one of the most common threads of later medieval devotion, and that's like devotion to Christ's humanity. It's exactly this affective experience of the passion that I was talking about when we first started, right? That it's this kind of affective experience that Bernard is striving for. It's this affective experience that many contemplatives are trying to get at. But for Hilton, that seems to be not the most critical thing. And there's a passage in his epistle on the mixed life, which I find hugely compelling. So the epistle on the mixed life is written for someone who has responsibilities on earth in this mortal life, who has children, who has servants, is in a position we can kind of infer of some nobility, but is also desiring this contemplative life. And Hilton says, some people spend all their time cultivating this image of Christ's passion. They think about it obsessively and they devote all their compassion, all their pity, all their tears to the image of this individual. And what they're not looking at is the suffering that's all around them. And they offer no material assistance to the suffering that is all around them. They offer no assistance to the suffering of their children, of their inferiors. And he has a pretty strong indictment of this. Like for him, that is ethically wrong. And I think the notion that passion devotion and your own emotional engagement with the stuff of the passion could in fact be ethically dubious is pretty startling.
Oh, that is absolutely true.
Yeah. And when we think about the fact that Hilton dies in 1396, less than 2 decades later, you have Archbishop Arundel rubber stamping Nicholas Love's Meditations on the Life of Christ, which is this translation of the Pseudo Bonaventura Meditationes Vita Christi. And it is a text that has at its core the notion that the main purpose of devotion should be cultivating this intimate, compassionate engagement with the passion of Christ. And the fact that Hilton is interrogating the balance between that and your earthly responsibilities is really striking to me and seems to me to open up a lot of interesting intersections between Hilton, someone whom we regard as very orthodox, but then also things which are considered less orthodox at the same period in time. You have kind of similar interrogations of the ethics of passion meditation and affective devotion in Wycliffe writings, for example, or thinking about the descriptions of The Passion and Piers Plowman and how profoundly like unaffecting they are. Yeah, Hilton is a person who, as much as he says that a contemplative's duty is to leave behind the life of the world, he is also very insistent on the kind of moral stakes of the life of the world. And I think that's another thing about him as a pastoral thinker, as much as a mystic. His advice is very clearly flexible and tailored to the specific situations of the people he's writing for. So this stuff about your earthly responsibilities is much less present in The Scale, which is addressed to an anchoress, than it is in On the Mixed Life, which is addressed to someone seeking to navigate in between these two things. I think that's one of the things that makes me think Hilton, unlike some other writers, is not simply inventing these addresses as a devotional fiction. He has very concrete, grounded, very well situated advice for individuals.
I really like that. And him tailoring these things to the people asking for this advice. I mean, that's why you approach a spiritual advisor. You want something specific to your own lived experience, your own practice. If you could get there on the general writings and scriptures that are meant for people at large, then you wouldn't need this kind of personalized attention. But they can't, and so they're approaching him specifically, and he's giving them things tailored to them. That's fantastic.
Yes, exactly. But then there's kind of also the remarkable thing of these things that feel very specifically tailored are also circulating in a pretty massive way, and circulating in compilations, circulating in excerpts. People clearly take from it what is of service to them, and again, particularly The Scale. And people find profit in the advice of it, even though, as we know, there are like, so Scale, addressed to an anchoress, there are something like, but I think the highest estimates are like 200, 400 anchoresses and anchorites in England in the 14th century. So a tiny fraction of the devout population, the Christian population, but it's being read much more widely than that. And that combination of specificity and generalizable matter is, I think, one of the things that makes Hilton so enduring as a voice.
Do we know much about these relationships with these people that he's writing to? Is he writing for the same people over and over again? Or are these one-off communications to help with particular problems? Do we know about his role as a guide on kind of like an ongoing basis?
As far as we know, he's not writing to the same person multiple times. But Hilton is kind of in it for the long haul of an individual's devotional life. He's basically trying to stay with people through the changes that they can experience over the course of their life as a devotee.
Okay, so he's not providing specific guidance for singular individuals from the outset of the religious life through towards presumably death, but instead is trying to encompass the varieties of feelings and stages within a devotional life in a more general sense.
Yes, and I think that notion of the religious life as one of flux of feeling and flux of thought runs strongly through all of his work. A bit that I really like in The Scale, where he says, whoever perceives no changeability, no fluidity in the feeling of his grace, but experiences everything constantly stable and whole, he is either fully perfect or else he's fully blind. And that's remarkable, right? That with Hilton, we don't just have a snapshot of a single moment of ecstasy or revelation. Instead, we have this notion of what it is to sit day in, day out, and also year on year with feelings that crest and the crests and troughs of a mystical life. And I think we have that sense of kind of the long durée of a contemplative or mystical life. Also the deepening of thought between book one and book two of The Scale of Perfection, the ways in which he's responding to further inquiries, tugging at different threads in contemplative existence. He's writing for people for whom love of God is, and feeling for God is a life's work, and a life's work that kind of evolves and changes day by day. And if it doesn't, you're either fully perfect or you're fully blind. And very few of us are fully perfect in this life.
I mean, speak for yourself. We are now coming towards the end of the podcast, and Rowan, that just means we have the final question. Why is it that you wanted to talk about Walter Hilton today? Why is he your favorite mystic?
Okay, firstly, because he's no one's favourite mystic except for mine. If Walter Hilton is also your favourite mystic, please get in touch with me. He doesn't get his flowers, he doesn't get his laurels. He's perceived as deeply dull. But I think I've not read anyone from the period who feels to me like such an intimate companion for like the life of my own brain and the torments of the brain. I think he's a person to sit with, not when you are transcendently, ecstatically in oneness with the divine or in oneness with whatever form of love you're striving to be in contact with, but he's a person to sit with the rest of the time. And most of us live in the rest of the time. And that's what he keeps saying. And I'm also just very compelled by dropouts and by people who abandon some aspects of life. And I think thinking about Hilton as in some ways an extraordinarily productive failure, I find that very moving and compelling. And someone who lives in like what Halberstam might call the queer art of failure, right? Like thinking about someone who is able to transform what we can infer quite potentially quite devastating experiences into work of such compassion and kindness. I think he's a very kind mystic. I think that's quite lovely.
Any other Walter Hilton fans out there, please tweet at us, get in touch, let Rowan know that they are not alone in their admiration for this fascinating man.
More Hilton fans, 24th of March. We're gonna hang out. We're gonna go to Thurgerton.
Incredible. Rowan, thank you so much for being on the podcast today and for telling me all about Walter Hilton.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you all for listening. You can follow us on Twitter at MyFaveMystic. We're also starting to upload back episodes to YouTube at MyFaveMystic. So check us out there and join me next time when I speak to Barbara Newman about Charles Williams.